Much of the content in the first part of the programme this morning requires an advance warning. Some of it is distressing, and as a listener, you should exercise your own judgment and discretion. Almost 2,400 allegations of sexual abuse against 884 people. Much of it happened in environments where children should have been nourished and empowered. Instead, they were assaulted in terror and silence. Childhoods were ended prematurely, and countless lives were impacted forever. News began to emerge on Tuesday morning that a scoping inquiry into allegations of abuse in schools run by religious orders was due to be published. Liam O'Brien, whose seismic documentary on One, Black Rock Boys, led to many new victims coming forward, spoke to Claire Byrne.
Days like today, or what's expected to happen today in terms of announcements, they don't come along that often. I mean, victims like David, they spent their almost their entire adult lives not being believed, you know, decades. And for those of us who aren't victims, we will never understand how something like today would be totally and utterly life-changing, I think, for people like David.
We're going to hear Mark Ryan speaking about when he first went to Blackrock College as a 12-year-old boy.
My parents, they were very proud that I went to Blackrock College. They thought it was a fantastic school. My father had to leave school when he was quite young because his father had died and he had to go out and work. He really wanted the best education for his children. They thought that Blackrock College was it for me.
During Mark's first year at Blackrock College, one of the teachers began to take a special interest in him.
I was befriended by one of the teachers there, a priest. He saw that I had an interest, I suppose, in basic maths and computers and things like that. And there was a little computer society.
This priest, Mark's teacher, gave him his own computer, a rare thing in 1970s Ireland.
I now realise I was being groomed. It's a relatively new thought for me. And when I see things now, my understanding is my parents were being groomed.
The priest who was grooming Mark was a Holy Ghost father, or Spiritan, as they're now known.
So I was in Blackrock College. This particular priest, I'm going to call him the perpetrator because this is what actually happened, the perpetrator, used to invite me down for swimming down in Willow Park, which was the primary school connected to the secondary school. It had its own swimming pool. A Friday evening, Saturday evening, go down for a swim, which was fantastic in its own way, be able to go for a swim. Well, that's part of the grooming, being chosen, made to feel special. And he was coming up to our house. My parents thought he was fantastic.
Liam was also struck by the way some survivors engaged with the scoping inquiry team and what it said about their own personal trauma.
Just to give you one kind of example that I found very emotional, it really resonates, is that a lot of victims, particularly those who fed in on not on an anonymous basis, but their identities would be withheld from the publication, but not their testimony, is that a lot of older men were contacted the inquiry team from the car, from their car, from the safety of that car and from the loneliness of that car. And that for the first time in their lives, they were articulating what had happened to them in terms of their abuse to the scoping inquiry team.
So they were making the call in the car because they didn't want anyone in their family to know what had happened to them.
The term historical abuse is quite, well, it's used all the time in relation to instances like this. But whilst the abuse itself might have been historical, the effects of it, they go on not just for the person who is still alive 40, 50, 60 years later, but it also goes on into future generations.
Oh, the effects are current.
Later in the day, Barry Lenehan joined Cormac on Drive Time to analyse some of the shocking statistics in the report.
700 pages, this report, laying out in grim detail allegations of abuse at schools across all parts of the country between the years 1927 to 2013, but more specifically, predominantly looking at allegations in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s. The scoping inquiry set up after the documentary on One here, Blackrock Boys, featuring brothers David Ryan and now deceased Mark Ryan, over two 200 survivors engaged with that inquiry, but the scoping inquiry led by Senior Counsel Mary O'Toole, mm-hmm. it asked religious orders across Ireland to provide figures based from their own records on the allegations of abuse. And what they've been returned with from the religious orders is the following figures: 2,395 allegations of historical abuse is the number held in religious orders records at present, 884 alleged abusers in respect of 308 schools, and half of those 884 alleged abusers are still alive this evening. Of the 73 religious orders who run schools currently or who have run schools in Ireland, 42 of the 73 reported allegations of abuse. Now, amongst the allegations, there are 17 special schools, which would be schools which look after children and provide education to children with special needs and learning difficulties. In those, 590 allegations of abuse pertaining to 190 alleged abusers.
Drive Time also carried Education Minister Norma Foley's speech in the Dáil, which was emotional, especially when the minister detailed the impact abuse had on victims.
The level of abuse is shocking. It is truly shocking. And so is the number of alleged abusers. The report is a harrowing document and contains participants' descriptions of appalling sexual abuse and violence. This includes abuse being perpetrated in front of other children. Participants in the inquiry told us that it led to the premature end of their childhood. From my heart, I want to say, uppermost in my thoughts today are the survivors. I want to thank them for their patience and their courage. I wish to remember and acknowledge in particular the late Mark Ryan, who with his brother David was instrumental in the establishment of the scoping inquiry. He is also very much in our hearts today, and I am mindful that the first anniversary of his passing is approaching in the coming weeks.
On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, as the scale and significance of the scoping inquiry began to hit home, Audrey Carvel summed up the feelings of many and the sense of historical déjà vu as Irish society once again was forced to acknowledge intergenerational trauma and abuse.
After the Ryan report, the Murphy report, the investigations into the mother and baby institutions, the Magdalen laundries, it might feel that we can't be shocked by the scale and the brutality of the terror inflicted on children by some members of the Catholic Church and those who work in religious-run institutions. And yet, what has now been revealed by those investigating allegations of abuse in schools run by religious orders is really quite shocking. Some children went to extreme lengths to avoid going back to school to face further abuse. RTÉ's primetime programme last night heard from a number of men who were abused. Michael Mansfield was preyed upon and assaulted at both Willow Park and Blackrock College in Dublin.
It was a very painful time for me, a time I really felt I had nowhere to go in terms of telling my story, and had to figure out a way on my own how to deal with it. It took a long time to come to terms with it. But I was very lucky that I had a very supportive family that was there for me and gave me support in many ways and helped me cope with it in lots of ways. But it did have a very serious impact in terms of my life going forward.
Cornelius Crowley is originally from Cork. He was placed in guardianship when his mother became ill. He was sexually abused in 5 boarding schools in this state from the age of 5 and a half. He now lives in London. He said the abuse had a profound impact on his whole life.
I didn't start counselling on this until I was 62. I've carried it inside myself all my life. I've been walking around with paranoia going on inside me. I'd be interacting with people and be paranoid about it and not say anything and try and cope with that and try and behave normally. For all of my life, I've been depressed, I've been homeless, I've been on drugs. It's been a mess because I have not been able to trust anyone or trust myself. And I internalise it all as there was something wrong with me.
All week, Liveline heard heart-wrenching accounts from survivors detailing distressingly familiar stories of perpetrators being moved from area to area, protected by a largely silent and indifferent society.
They had transferred them to Sierra Leone,
yeah.
And he abused then in a school that he went to there in Christ the King College in Bowen, Sierra Leone. I tracked down through a college friend my contemporaries in Africa. So when I was a boy, where were the Africans? And I wanted to meet with them who had received then Maloney, and found out from them that he had continued his abuse. Not only from the get-go, he continued his abuse. He caused consternation in the place. The senior form boys had to deal with his abusing the first form boys, and they decided to hold a protest, and at night time drew lewd pictures of what he had been doing to the first form boys.
Yeah.
The following morning, assembly is called. The superior of the college calls the assembly and says, step forward, whoever sort of like did this. 12 boys stepped forward.
Incredible.
They were all in their final years before going to university. They were all expelled from the college and nearly ruined their lives, all because they were willing to defend. They weren't the ones abused. Mm-hmm. They were willing to defend the first form boys from what had been going on with Maloney's presence and arrival at the school. He was never turfed out for that. He stayed on for another 5 years at the school. Those 12 boys, some of them were fine. They had rich families, as rich might go in Africa, and Sierra Leone, one of the poorest countries in Africa. Mm. So they were able to sort of like weather it, but there were some that were on scholarships, and that proved very difficult for them. And to me, those 12 lads are heroes. Because not if we had them ourselves, but because of what they did, they risked everything for justice, for right at the time when it really mattered or counted. One story which inspired me was that one of the boys who had been abused, a first form boy, and I just call him Harry. Harry, anyway, was sort of like, he comes forward to tell of his abuse to his father, and his father, who is just a convert from what was the animism of Sierra Leone to Christianity and Catholicism, believed that his son was the spawn of the devil.
My God.
And said that he must be wrong about a holy man saying such a thing about him. His father dispossessed him and turned away from him. 40 years it took for him to restore that broken bond. When he received the notice of Maloney's conviction here, from my case and that of Paul Daly's. And he takes this note, it was published in the Irish Times, and I sent it on down to the lads because I'd made a connection at that point. And Harry got his copy to go to his father, and he brings it to his father.
Yeah.
And his father reads it and breaks down in tears and says, I don't know why I didn't believe you, my own flesh and blood, over that man. And what had been 40 years of a broken bond, a broken bond between a father and a son, was restored.
Yeah.
If I needed conviction as to why my case was worthwhile and going through all of that process, to have that story for the end of it, that gift, then it was worth it.
And that was Mark Vincent Healy's powerful testimony as heard on Lifeline. And if you've been impacted by any of the material this morning, rte.ie/helplines has a list of resources and counselling services. Let's take a small breather. Cork musician John Bleck, who's on the RT Radio 1 Recommends list, performed this version of a Bob Dylan classic on Monday's Ray Darcy show.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If this time to you is worth saving, you'd better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Now the times, they are a-changing. So come, senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled. And the battle outside is raging. It'll soon shake the window and rattle the walls. Other times they are a-changing. And camaraders and critics who prophesize with their pens, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon while the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling a who that it's naming. For the losers now, later will win. Other times they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, you can't criticize what you can understand. And your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. And the old road is rapidly aging. Please get out a new one if you can't lend a hand. The times they are a-changing. It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, just as present now will later be past. And the order is rapidly changing. Please get out a new one if you can't lend a hand. The times they are.
Back shortly. Welcome back. TV host, best-selling author and unofficial West Cork ambassador Graeme Norton was on with Oliver Callan on Wednesday to talk about his new novel, Frankie. No prizes then for guessing where geographic inspiration for the novel came from.
Frankie, when we meet her, she's old, she's living in East London, and she hurts her leg, and she has a young carer, an Irish guy called Damien, and they're from the same little bit of West Cork, mm-hmm. and that kind of sparks a conversation, and she starts telling the story of her life, and you go back to West Cork in the late 40s, and then it goes all the way through London in the 60s, New York in the 70s and 80s, and we find out what happened to Frankie.
Yeah, because I gather the three places you know the best on earth
are in this book.
West Cork, London, New York, and lo and behold, Frankie. Yeah.
Well, Frankie ended up in those places. Yeah, Vietnam didn't appeal. She didn't go there.
Frankie notices the English Protestants who come to the service in Cork and the way they're dressed.
Yeah, well, that's from Bandon. I do remember that. Like, you'd notice the English, they were just different.
Only people who didn't have to be up to milk the cows could have put such care into their appearance.
I know. Whew. I remember going to a funeral once in Bandon, and there was a woman wearing sunglasses. Well, we knew she wasn't from Bandon.
The glamour startled the place for too long. There's loads of intricate detail about cooking and her chef work here. She's an exceptional cook or chef.
Yeah.
Are you very good in the kitchen? It seems to be so detailed.
Not really. I mean, I've worked in restaurants. I worked in restaurants for a long time.
8 years, I believe.
Well done, Mr. Research. Oh, I'm
thank
very good
you,
on
you.
It. yeah, so I think that's where some of that authentic stuff comes from, is just working in restaurants and knowing what goes on.
You must be lovely to serve staff as a result of your years of toil.
Oh, yes, now, lovely, yes, lovely to waiting staff.
when there were colleagues, no.
Yeah, and also, no, I thought you meant like customers, and I was like, no, I was terrible to customers.
Were you?
Well, I started off being good, because I was, you know, this young little Irish boy in London serving people, and I was so friendly and nice, and I would do that thing, you know, I'd go up to them after the meal and go, and would you like dessert? And they'd go, no, thank you. And I go, are you sure? Like I was doing some American hard sell. I was just being polite. That's what you do. People don't mean no. People don't mean no.
No,
so you
they
go,
don't.
Are you
Stop
sure you don't want dessert? And people look at me like, back off. Yeah, we just told you we don't want dessert.
Go on, go on, go on, go on. No conversation with Graham Norton would be complete, of course, without reference to his star turn in Father Ted.
This person said, we're always very impressed by Graham's acting ability in Father Ted. He really did excel. I love the episode with the Irish dancing in the caravan. It's a classic. So what was it like on the set of Father Ted? The crack must have been crazy with Dermot Morgan, Ard Lohanlon, Frank Pauline. And that's from Jimmy in Dundalk.
Well, Jimmy, the odd thing was that, so, you know, the four main people, like, they're there every week. And they could have just been a little clique if they'd wanted to be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, blow-ins for one episode, why bother? They couldn't have been nicer, so open and friendly. And then that caravan, they'd filmed all the stuff in Ireland first, so I never filmed in Ireland, so the only people who filmed in Ireland and in the studio were the four main characters.
Right.
Everyone else either was on location
in
or in London.
Yeah.
So but what they did was they brought the real caravan.
Oh, did they?
They brought the actual caravan they'd filmed in the West of Ireland, over to London. That's what we were in. And I remember, so we get in, we're doing it, they're filming through the end window, and we do our Irish dancing. And so keen were we on our Irish dancing, we buckled the floor, and the door would no longer open. So myself and the youth group and Ardlan Dermot, we all had to climb out the end window,
the window
of the caravan.
Oh, I've got great memories.
I know. It was one of my first jobs. And it was such a happy time. You know, it made you kind of think, oh, this is great. I love this industry.
And the industry would come to love Graham in return. An issue which also got coverage this week was passenger numbers at Dublin Airport. Eamon Ryan, Minister for Environment, Climate, Communications and Transport, was on with Claire Byrne to respond to the fact that a passenger cap would be breached.
The cap is in existence going back to 2007, 2008. They are looking to have it raised, and that's a matter for the planning authorities. They have an application in with Fingal County Council for the development of the airport, but also to raise the cap.
Yeah, they will face consequences for that. You're clear on that, are you?
Well, that is, yes. Firstly, it's a matter of the local authority. Fingal County Council is the body responsible that has to enforce planning conditions.
Did they tell you in advance of publicly announcing it today that they are going to breach the passenger cap? Did they tell your department?
We're in regular contact. Again,
so you knew that wasn't a surprise to you this morning?
Well, we'd been, both the department, myself and Junior Minister Lawless now, we're in constant communication with the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been getting a lot of abuse from the likes of Michael O'Leary and others saying, oh, all you can do, all you have to do, Minister, is you just have to step in and address it and click your fingers and it'll all be solved. That's not possible. That's not true. That's not within the law. And unless you want to throw out the Irish Constitution, throughout the Irish legal system, and start having ministers running by fiat and diktat, then that's the way you go. But that's not how this country works. We are a democratic, constitutional republic. We live within the law, all of us.
But you don't want to see the passenger cap raised to 40 million, do you?
Aviation is probably going to be the most difficult, one of the most difficult areas to address in climate change. We benefit tremendously from the connectivity that aviation brings to us as an island, particularly. The way we'll manage aviation emissions, in my mind, is to really accelerate the provision of sustainable aviation fuel. In fairness to Ryanair, actually, they're probably ahead of the game in that. They're probably the number one airline in terms of buying up a lot of the sustainable aviation fuel across Europe. I want them to start to be able to buy that in Dublin and in Cork and Shannon, particularly. And it's my job as Minister of Energy to set up the conditions where we can develop and deliver that.
Mm-hmm. Later in the same programme, Ryanair's Michael O'Leary responded in a non-confrontational and understated way. Only joking.
Yeah, he's a spoofer. You know, the issue is we're already over the limit of 32 million passengers. This year, Dublin Airport will do 33 million passengers. And the traffic hasn't collapsed. The airport hasn't collapsed. The big issue is the IAA are under pressure to limit the seats at Dublin Airport, which is why they're not giving us the slots for our extra flights at Christmas, or they're looking for all the airlines to reduce seats by a million next year. And all we're saying to this incompetent minister is send a letter to the IAA instructing them to take
He says he's not going to get involved in the planning issue. But even more importantly, right, forget
it's
all
not
that.
A planning
no, forget
issue.
Forget name calling and all of that,
it
right?
Isn't a planning he, issue.
If you heard him this morning, you heard him saying he's not averse to 40 million
he's
passengers.
Away.
But he's not averse. He's almost on your side
he's not
here.
Averse, doesn't he? But why hasn't he done something about it?
It's a planning issue. It's not up to him. He can't intervene in that.
It is time for the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste to take action on this. We are sending jobs, tourists and growth to Italy and to Poland because we cannot get the extra slots that we want to grow this summer, this or the to put on the traditional Christmas extras or next summer as well.
You have put extra flights on in Cork, though, haven't you? You've made that announcement. So this desire of the government to spread development is working because it's sort of forcing you to do that.
We've added about 10, 20 extra flights to Cork a week. It's nothing compared. Normally at Christmas, in the 10 days prior to Christmas and out to about the 3rd of January, we add about 20,000 extra flights in and out of Dublin Airport, mainly from London and from the UK.
Do you know why Kenny Jacobs was said this morning? It's not a problem for Ryanair this Christmas. I mean, surely he knows that those seats haven't been permitted this year.
Of course he knows. But, I mean, Kenny's a bit of a PR spoofer anyway, so Kenny just wants good news out there for the DAA. We cannot have the main gateway airport on our island constrained, particularly at a time when we've just opened a second runway, which takes capacity to 60 million passengers.
I see there's a response in from Kenny Jacobs on what you said. I think you called him a spoofer. He said he learned from the best of them.
There you go.
Kenny Jacobs landing a decent blow on his former colleague Michael O'Leary. There was also a separate story with big numbers making headlines this week.
Construction and installation, €283,949. And then you have VAT on top of that. Contract admin services, €10,816.
And all of that for a bike shelter. Reporter Maura Fay put the Vox Pop to good use when she asked people in RD what they made of it all.
Why is it there?
Do you think it's too much money?
Yeah. It's a shade. That's all it is. Like, for God's sake. An old metal bar and tie your bike to it, like.
Absolutely ridiculous. You wouldn't spend that money on it?
Not on a bike shed.
Well, someone said you can buy them for a couple of thousand online or whatever, which sure is typical of what the state money has been used for. Yeah, all the homeless people and people who are on waiting lists for houses and then to go spending over 300,000 on a bike shed. Doesn't make much sense, does it?
Well, I think if it was me or you, we'd have to answer for it. That's really it. I think, you know, it's ridiculous. Sure, that's the price of a small house now. People can't even afford that to buy a house. They're buying a bike shed with it.
It's a disgrace. Yeah, there's people sleeping on the streets. People can't survive anymore and they've no, like, they're spending that on a bike shed. There's one bike in the shed this morning from what I've seen.
Even Nasa Harrigan, Green Party TD for Dublin Central, a party usually all for cycling infrastructure, felt she couldn't justify the cost of the bike shelter.
It's hard to see how it can be justifiable, and people are totally right. It is the cost of constructing a house. And I heard that lady say it's just a shed. It's not even a shed. You know, it's an L-shaped canopy. So your bike's possibly still going to get wet.
They say in this statement where they've given those costs that the structure consists of a steel-framed, glazed canopy to ensure long-term durability. The materials used, including Irish granite, glass and steel, were carefully selected not only for their durability but also for their compatibility with the historic setting of our National Parliament. Now, how important is that factor? It had to fit with what's already there in Leinster House. Like, it couldn't have been a plastic lean-to.
You know, it's a bike shed at the rear of the building against another building. So it sits against, for people who don't know the site very well, it sits against the National Gallery and Library complex. So one of the points that the OPW made is it's a very sensitive site and also that there is a prevailing wind there. Well, you know, it's actually a sheltered area. And yes, it is a sensitive site, but I'm not sure it's a €300,000 sensitive site. And this is effectively a very, very simple structure.
Now, what do you get if you mix this with this? Well, you get Brian McFadden and Keith Duffy, who were on with Oliver to announce a new Irish and World Tour.
Keith Duffy and Brian McFadden, our Boys Life, live in studio. You're very welcome this morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How are we?
You don't look so bad now. It's amazing what they can do in surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've Louis Walsh's doctor. It's great.
Oh, the digs begin. You're over, guys. You're over. It's over.
So we got together to do an autobiographical show around the UK. We called the show Boys Life, Stories, Laughter and Music. Mm-hmm. We never knew it would organically grow into what it is today. We've written and recorded our own studio album. We've been on the road now for 8 years.
Listen, I've been in Boys Life now longer than I was in Westlife, which is mad to think.
It's time that we came home and you know, did our show for the fans here in Ireland. Just to clarify for all the fans out there of Boyzone and Westlife, if they're wondering why we're called Boys Life, obviously it's a play on Boyzone and Westlife. If they're wondering why we didn't call ourselves Westzone, there was already a name taken by a car park at Dublin Airport.
Westzone. It'd never have taken off, really. Back shortly. Welcome back. One of the world's most successful writers, Lee Child, he of Jack Reacher fame, spoke to Brendan O'Connor about how someone becomes a writer. In his case, it was fairly simple, really. He just needed to lose his good job.
I had a great job. I loved that job at Granada TV in Manchester. And it was lovely, lovely company until the last couple of years when they did that 1990s thing. People all over the world experienced the same thing. They just threw you out and got cheaper people or computers or whatever. So I walked up to W.H. Smith and I bought a paper and a pencil and I wrote that first book as a desperate means to pay my bills. You know, I had no other alternative. And so that's a long time ago now, but I remember it well, sitting down, starting, thinking, can I do it? What lies ahead? It was fantastic.
And how did you decide and have the confidence to think, I'll write books?
Because I'd been a reader, you know, all my life. I'd been a huge, huge reader. I loved books. Played a sort of trick on myself to take the doubt out of it. I said, yeah, this is definitely going to work, which is actually a crazy thing to say because you never know.
Yeah. But, and was the extraordinary success a surprise to you?
Yeah, it was, of course. You know, I hoped that it would be an extraordinary success because, of course, you do. You know, you hope it's going to work. It's the most magnificent thing. You know this because of your job. You never know how the public is going to react. You can plan, you can expect, but you never know.
Yeah, you can't control them, can you, Lee? That's the problem with the public.
That's the problem, yeah.
Oh, Brendan, you've said the thinking bit out loud again. In recent years, Lee has passed on the Jack Reacher series to his sibling Andrew. Brendan put it to him, it's not very common to hear of writers deciding to retire from book writing.
No, it's not a thing. You know, usually they work till they're dead and then carry on afterward with somebody else. But I love retirement. I just love the idea. You know, it's a very British thing. You go to school for a bit and then you work for a very long time.
Yeah.
And then you retire. It's a thing. You do retired guy things. And I want to do that. You know, why not?
Isn't it funny? Your parents struggled so hard to make you middle class. And there you are. You have that middle class bourgeois notion of, you know, a man does his time and then time for retirement. So do you write anymore? Will you write still?
Yeah, I do short stories now and then. I do articles for newspapers or magazines. Writing is something that you can't get away from. You just have a thought and you feel compelled. You've got to put it down in a form that is understandable and communicates. So I'm sure I'll always do that. I think retirement actually is a bit of an illusion. It's probably not going to happen 100%.
You're probably as well off. The more retired guys I meet, like, a lot of them are kind of seem to be slightly at a loose end. Do you have hobbies and stuff?
Reading is my main hobby, and that is the thing I'm doing mostly now, because when you write, you can't, obviously, while you're sitting there making up your own story, you can't be reading somebody else's. So I've got a huge, literally thousands of books that I haven't got to yet, and I'm looking forward to getting to them. Music is important to me as well. Then probably TV. There's a lot of things I need to catch up with. So what I won't be doing is playing golf or going to the gym or anything like that, because that is not me.
And listen, what better way to go into retirement than knowing exactly who you are and what is you and what isn't you? Safe Enough, your short story collection, is published by Penguin Random House and it's out now. Lee Child, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan. Appreciate it.
And off he goes to make a dent in that big pile of books on his bedside locker. For those of us still slogging away in the workplace, is it okay to miss your colleagues' birthdays? Well, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer revealed this week his staff forgot to wish him a happy birthday. Drive Time wanted to know if this was okay, so Damien McCarthy, who's CEO of HR Buddy, joined Sarah and Cormac.
I suppose call me old-fashioned. I think it's a very nice old tradition that we mark our work colleagues' birthdays. It's something that we all share, one birthday every year. It's celebratory. And I think there's something awfully sad and sterile about someone celebrating their birthday everywhere else but at work with their work colleagues. And I think it's a simple thing that we can just mark our work colleagues' birthdays.
And yet we had a text from one listener a little earlier on saying that he absolutely would not want someone to mark his birthday and that it would be a breach of GDPR if they did.
That is actually a good point. Not everyone wants this. What I would say, I'm very much in favour, and I think most people would be. Workplaces do need to be careful around these things and check in with individuals beforehand for permission. But I think most people enjoy a little bit of tea and birthday cake for their work colleagues' birthday.
You're making me feel bad. I don't think I have ever wished someone happy birthday in work, ever. Bought them a card, bought them a gift.
You don't even know when my birthday is.
Nothing. I wouldn't have a clue. Not a buzz.
I'm very sorry to hear that, Sarah. I'm sure he'll make more of an effort next year.
It's too late.
The only thing I know is I think she's a good bit older than me. But forced fun, Damien, in the workplace is not good, is it? I mean, come on, let's celebrate Damien's birthday. And Damien, with gritted teeth, is coming down to the canteen.
Yeah, but I think, again, there's something very sad and sterile about someone getting up in the morning, celebrating with their kids, going home in the evening, having birthday cake, and then going into work with their work colleagues and it not even being mentioned. Post-COVID, there's more remote working, more hybrid arrangements, more flexible working patterns and so on. And workplaces are looking to connect their staff.
We were talking about it earlier. And we were just wondering, is there anecdotal evidence that if you do mark someone's birthday, that the organisation of it tends to fall to the women in the office, the cake and the card?
Well, very interesting, actually. There has been research done on this, and Pittsburgh University carried out research which showed that those kind of non-essential work tasks were falling predominantly to women, and it was underappreciated, whilst organisations very much valued, things like marking work colleagues' birthdays, organising the event, the card and the work that went into it. It was very much underappreciated, and I suppose the men just show up and eat the cake.
Damien.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Damien. I really couldn't have said it better myself.
Ah, let them eat cake. I just really hope I don't get Cormac in the office Chris Kendall this year. Someone who doesn't overindulge on cake is 74-year-old Colette O'Hagan. She's on course to be the first woman in Ireland to run 1,000 marathons. She also succeeded in a first by leaving Ray Darcy almost speechless.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
I'm lost for words.
Oh, really? It's not like you to be lost for words. I really got you there.
Well, I'm just doing the maths on it. Like, that's 26,000 miles before you add in training. And you only started running late in life, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't start till I was in my 40s when the kids were a little bit older and stuff like that. And I didn't like it at all.
Do you mind me telling them what age you are?
Oh, not at all. My saying is I don't deny my age. I defy it.
I love that. Now, it's a big leap, right, from running up and down the shore road with the dog and Larry of an evening to heading towards your 1,000th marathon.
At that time, because I was in the early 90s was when I did my first marathon in Dublin. So it would have been probably 89. I joined the group of women called the Don Brady Joggers in Dundalk.
Right.
And they were training for the women's mini marathon.
So you're in your 40s. Early 40s.
Just in my early 40s. So I decided I would do the Dublin City Marathon. Now talk about going a big step further.
Yes.
So at that time, you didn't have any gadgets or gizmos or any of those things or gels or things like that. So I decided, how do I train for it? Because I had no idea. I hadn't a clue. So the Irish Runner was a great magazine at the time.
Frank Greely, editor. They
had a great program in it every year to train for the Dublin City, and they still have it. So that's what I trained on that that programme. I took put it up on the back door, the kitchen back door, and now I was looking at that every weekend, go for the long run, make the dinner, off I go.
Now, that's one marathon in 1 year, right? So how does it go from that to, like, you could describe it as an obsession, could you?
Well, I actually think if you don't have a little bit of an obsession in it, you wouldn't stick it. Yes. Do you know what I mean? Yes. There has to be a bit of madness here somewhere. Right. So anyway, right. Yeah.
Well, you said it, definitely, I didn't say
yeah,
it.
Yes. No, I know what you mean, though. There is a bit of an obsession and probably a little bit of an addiction. October 27 is the 1,000.
And the big news, and we said it already, Colin Farrell is running the marathon as well.
I know. God, will I get to meet him, I wonder.
I might know somebody who knows somebody.
Oh, thank you, Ray. Thank you, Ray.
I'd say if Colin knew.
Oh, all the women would be jealous if I get to meet Colin.
Colette O'Hagan with Ray, friend of the stars, Darcy. Bowman Sunday last weekend deviated from a planned programme to pay tribute to an equally inspiring woman, Nell McCafferty. John Bowman succeeded in extracting some gems from the archives, and one in particular stood out, and it was Nell's interview with Miriam O'Callaghan, with Nell in reflective mood as she articulated getting older.
I looked after for a long time my mother, my sister when she was disabled. They're dead. I will never look after anybody again. It is hard and difficult.
You live alone?
I do.
Is that lonely?
Yes. I don't like it. But I'm such a grumpy old woman. I wouldn't let anybody in to live with me.
Do you look back now and think how difficult it was for you as a gay woman to come out? When you look at younger people today, yes. Younger women, younger men, it's still not very easy, but it's much easier to come out and be gay today, isn't it, than when you were young?
Oh, yeah. But you see, when you're young and gay, as I was in the 50s and 60s, nobody noticed you were gay. And friendship among women has always been great, particularly in a place like Derry, where all the women worked in the shirt factories and kept the economy going. It was normal.
Would you like to fall in love again? I mean, the great love of your life was Nuala Whelan.
Yes, she'll be 6 years dead this year.
Do you still miss her?
I miss her voice.
Okay.
But I channel it. What would Nuala have thought? But that was what was unique about her, her take on things.
Do you think you've had, when you look back, it's a bit of a hopeless word really, but a happy life?
Much of it was happy. Yeah. Enjoyable would be the best word. Yeah, I was delighted with my life and doing things and achieving things. The women's movement and the civil rights movement, yes. We achieved good things. That was great. That was great.
When asked had she any regrets in her life, Nell responded in her typical candid style.
You see, the thing about my adult life, certainly since I was about 20, is I've been highly politicised and heavily involved in various revolutions, civil rights in the North or feminism in the South. And I realised when with the ceasefire, I didn't know what was in the top 10, musically. And had not known since 1968. I'd forgotten that, you know, that teenage thing with music 24 hours a day. I loved it then. I had lost touch with joy. My joy was revolution. And it was great at times. Oh, I loved it. I was real happy. Getting the right thing done and seeing people's lives tangibly improved, which is a purely practical thing. Once you're happier than you were, I have you off my back. It's making my life happy, but I didn't take time.
In terms of the mindfulness, do you think when you look back and you do this now, the mindfulness, and it's good for you, that you perhaps wasted too much time in your past life bearing grudges against people?
What I did as a revolutionary was I had my revolution 7 days a week. That was wrong. I wish now I'd taken the seventh day off. I should have gone to the pictures more often. I should have played my records more often.
The late Nell McCafferty speaking with Miriam O'Callaghan as heard on Bowman Sunday. We just have time to dip into the very eclectic record collection of singer-songwriter Oisin Leach, who presents Caravan Radio. On the programme, you're likely to get everything from Johnny Greenwood to Van Morrison. This week he even had an Arctic Monkey leave a voice message.
Now then, the phone here is saying one new message has arrived in. It's flashing red here. Let's listen.
Hey, Oisin. Hello, everyone. It's Nick O'Malley from Arctic Monkeys. Not that one. Sorry. The bass player. Sorry. You tuned into Caravan Radio with Oisin Leach, and this track is called House of Woodcock. It has a lovely dreamlike quality, perfect for a caravan. Enjoy.
Towards the end of Wednesday night's programme, Oisin played this wonderful recording of actor Richard Burton reading the Dylan Thomas poem, In My Craft or Sullen Art. I'll leave you with this. Till next time.
In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labour by singing light, not for ambition or bread or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write on these spindrift pages, nor for the towering dead with their nightingales and psalms, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art.